Are you concerned about your safety or the safety of America? This podcast is with Ptolemy Pruden, the author of China Rising, A Case for Containment. Now, this is part two, but you can listen to part one on episode number 197. So please do that and then listen to this. It doesn't matter actually which order. They are both very important. So in this podcast, we're going to talk about the economics of war, how it affects you, me, all of us as individuals, and the country. So please sit back and listen to the podcast. And before you do that, let me ask, are you a pet owner? Please remember to have your pets spayed or neutered. All right, let's get into it. Once again, thanks for joining Amazing People, Amazing Things. And the last time that we got together, you were absolutely amazing, just filling me in, filling all of us in on the information from your book.
Happen to have one with me. It's called China Rising, The Case for Containment. China Rising, The Case for Containment. And you can get that at www.thechinarisingbook.com, thechinarisingbook.com. And it's going to be a fun topic to talk about. And I can't think of a better person to talk to than you, Chuck.
Well, thanks. And in fact, right behind you, you do have Common Sense Defense. So you do have a podcast that's going as well, right?
Yes, sir. So the Common Sense Defense is a podcast that we developed for the everyday American, the everyday American who needs to understand what's going on nationally from a national defense perspective. And so basically it's a tool that helps the everyday American understand that we have an economic component that we can play into our national defense, that we can support our men and women in the service, and that we can support our policymakers to develop fair and wise policies as it relates to national defense. And so I think that that is a job that all 333 million Americans play a part. And as you know, if we don't do our part, then we really don't have anything we can complain about the way things are going if we don't play our part. And I think that it's not just voting someone else in office. It's about going to your pocketbook and saying, instead of me buying this product that is a Chinese-owned company product that costs $1,000, understanding that 25% is going to go into the Chinese Communist Party's pocketbook. So we have to understand that as Americans that we all have a part to play. And when we understand it in a fair way, then we'll understand that, okay, let me dial back some of my expenditures, and that will help a lot.
Yeah, because, you know, your book is broken down in three different parts, and we did cover some history and policy and technology and warfare, but there's also, you know, the economics of war. And it's not necessarily when we say the economics of war that it's the fighting part, but it's the war on economy type of thing too, is how I want to think about it. Because like you said, you know, every dollar that we spend that's manufactured in China, it goes into a pool, which the government, military, all that funds, whatever it is that they are manufacturing, which it could be missiles, ships, tanks. And we don't do that. But can you explain to us a little bit more about how that pool of money, how that works in China compared to what it is in the U.S.?
Sure. So let's use the United States, for example, the baseline, I guess, for most the United States, maybe other Western democracies. So you have your regular tax base that your companies and your individuals are taxed on. That money goes into our national pool of money. And that pool of money has different levels of authorization for how it is appropriated. And so for us, the money that goes into the defense budget goes into the overall tax revenue. And then from that tax revenue is the national defense budget, which is currently about $850 billion. And so when you have the $850 billion, it has to be broken down to each one of the services. So some goes to the Army, some goes to the Navy, the Air Force, Marines, the Coast Guard, and also Space Force. And then there's also a component that goes to the National Intelligence Defense groups like NSA and groups that they're not specifically in the military, but they are part of an organization that needs money to operate and function. The Department of Energy has that because our nuclear weapons that we have, that is developed by and sustained and protected by the Department of Energy. It doesn't come from the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, although the weapons that they develop goes or distributed to those guys. So that money, all that budgetary money goes to those defense organizations, and that's what they use to execute the national defense strategy, which is, where do we deploy our troops? If we have this policy or this thing happens, what do we do? And what countries get money that, you know, that needs to be that needs to go to their country? Here's an example. The State Department handles the appropriations of weapons that go to other countries. So the money goes to the State Department, the budget, and they use that to buy American platforms, whether it's F-35s, whether it's missiles, stuff that goes to like Ukraine, that comes through the State Department facilitates that. So when you have all of our, that's how we do our budgetary operations for our national defense. Our national budget typically is about close to $8.5 to $9 trillion, and so the National Defense Authorization Act appropriates a certain percentage of that that goes to our operations. China, on the other hand, they do the exact same thing as it relates to taxing their system. Any government owned entity, company, whether it's a state owned enterprise or a company that is predominantly a Chinese owned company, they tax at 25%. So whatever that company sells internationally, 25% of that goes back into the budget for the CCP, because the CCP, not only is not the Chinese Communist Party, not only owns the company and the rights for the company to operate and gives them paperwork, but the Chinese Communist Party also owns the people, the machinery, and everything. So when we see an SOE, which is called a state-owned enterprise, yes, that's an all holistically owned Chinese company, but make no mistake about it, those companies and corporations that are privately owned, they are still at the behest and controlled and owned by the Chinese Communist Party. So you're splitting hairs saying, okay, only a Chinese owned, but basically any company that is inside the land of China, inside the borders of China, is that tax and all the capabilities go to the CCP. That being said, they have to leverage, what they do is they leverage the authority that they have over the people to make sure they keep fiscal responsibility, fiscal operations going. I don't want to say responsibilities, because they're in some seriously bad fiscal situations because of bad decisions that they've made, i.e. the political situation, the economic situation they currently have, which we can talk about later. But the Chinese, what they do is they leverage not only their ability to control the tax dollars coming in, they also leverage their ability to produce goods and services. So like an aircraft or a ship that they need to develop, they take away from the cost of that price by putting in additional sweeteners. So let's say they want to make a ship. They want to make 5 destroyers. And what they do is they'll tag in with the cost of the construction for that ship, 4, 5, or 6 different freighters or civilian ships, and they put those all together, and that takes the cost down. And so when they cut the steel for one thing, they'll appropriate and cut the steel for the other. And so those same people are working on dual systems, and that takes a cost down. For us in the United States, we sub out the material, give out the material to a company, and they hire all the people and buy the steel and do all those different things, and they take the price of that and they have to manage it. They don't have to do that with a state-owned company or a state-owned enterprise, because they can absorb all those extra costs. And so what they end up doing is, so it allows them to produce multiple ships inexpensively, or not as expensive as it would cost us to make a platform. So I think they have the type. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, it sounds like private enterprise, the way it's run here, would work for government as far as manufacturing and expenditures and things like that, making it more cost effective. This sounds really like about money management, and we're not doing that great of a job, it doesn't sound like.
Well, I mean, so to the point, it is about having $1 billion and breaking that $1 billion down to be the most efficient for your country, whether it's the China with their ₩1 billion or for us with $1 billion. Obviously, you have the exchange rate, so $1 billion is different than Chinese $1 billion. It's like a 4, 5, or 6 to 1 ratio, but and it used to be pegged to the dollar 1 to 1. But the yuan is what they use to get themselves above and beyond what they could get with normal operations. And so what they do, if you imagine throwing in stealing intellectual property, managing all the supply chain for a product. So each one of those things that you do to cut the cost down for your end product is a benefit for your nation. So that's what China does. And they leverage all that. They leverage all that to the nth degree. I think they have their newest destroyer is called the Type 55. And the one before that was a Type 52D. Not that any of that's important, but they were able to develop so many Type 52D destroyers. They were rolling out one, two, or three per year. So that's how they grow their Navy and have the largest numerical advantage over us, which is 355 ships currently. And they're projected by 2027 to have 440 ships. We're projected to have just 290 ships. So you're looking at those management components. Now, listen, you give me the right type of missiles, the right type of torpedoes, and the right type of platforms, that 440 ships that they have, they won't be around long. So the key is about it's maneuver. It's like maneuvering and so that you don't go to war. It's providing a deterrent so you don't go to war. And you need to ensure in your adversary that if we go to war, yeah, I may lose some platforms, but you're going to lose your whole Navy and half your Air Force. And so that's really what you're trying to assure your adversaries, that we are going to provide you so much destruction that there's no way that you're going to be able to rebuild in a 6 months or a year or 3 years. And so, because quite honestly, with the model that they currently, even if we sank all their ships, if you give them 5 to 7 years, they can rebuild, because then they're going to be mad. And they're going to put everything in. They're going to obviously stop feeding their people. And they're going to make sure that they can get everything they can. So you've got deterrence is your best option. You don't want to go to war. When you go to war, not only you're fighting that person, you're fighting the next generation, because there's some son or some daughter or somebody who's upset and angry. And they're going to want vengeance on their loss of what their father's honor was. And so when you fight a war, realize it's transgenerational. It goes from one side of the generation to another side of the generation. And it's going to continue on. That's why on history, you always look, go ahead, you see one war, and you see the second war 30, 20, 30 years later, because that's the kid coming up fighting his father's war. And so you don't want to go to war if you can. And if you do go to war, it needs to be utter destruction outside of nuclear, utter destruction of your adversary's military capabilities. And that way you can assure that you don't have to go to war again, because war is just a terrible thing.
Yeah. This whole thing is a scary thought, and I'm gonna say this word, and it's not that that you are saying it. So I just want people to know that. But this is, like I said, the transgenerational. It makes me think that it's genocide is a terrible word to use, but like I said, you need to have utter destruction, because if you leave one building block behind, it's just going to build up again. So yeah. Now I understand even more what you mean by about our armed forces needs to be so strong and so superior and to deter. Not because we want to go to war and destroy, but the whole point is to deter anything like that from happening. So now I understand that. If that's the point that you're trying to get across, I understand that now.
That's precisely it. And I think back in the old days, so in the Cold War days, so we're talking about cost here. We spent probably $8 to $10 trillion on our national nuclear defense capabilities and during the Cold War to prevent ourselves from going to war with the Russians, the Soviets at the time. And it worked. Yeah, we had our jockeying and maneuvering around. They would lose some planes here and there. We'd lose some planes here and there because of close operations, proximity operations. But as nations, we did not go to war with the Soviet Union. And so we developed, over the 50 years of that, we developed a modus operandi that prevented us from going to war. We don't have that structure in place with China. China is like, there are people on a mission, and the thought of jockeying back and forth, that's really not what they're interested in, not really. And we don't know how to deal with that. And I think fighting and positioning your country against a European-based country, and fighting and positioning yourself against an Asian-based country are two different things. I think that China looks at the long range thing. We're short-sighted. Americans typically are short-sighted, but we have to start thinking long range, Chuck. We have to start thinking 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years so that we can have the right thought processes as it relates to deterrence, as it relates to building our military, as it relates to both our economic and our military goals and objective for our nation and our scientific goals and for our nation. And so those are the things we have to look at. And the mutual assured destruction was a term that was kicked around back in the old Cold War days. And that's where that kind of concept comes out. I've got so many nuclear weapons that it's going to destroy everything you have. And we both have common sense to know, let's not push the envelope. And so China did not have, even though they had weapons in the late 60s, they did not have that mindset. They weren't jockeying back and forth with us for those generations, those decades. And so now we're just getting into a situation where we're now competing from a Cold War perspective with China. And we make no mistake about it, we are in a Cold War right now and have been for by maybe a decade and didn't even recognize it because we were fighting the war on terror. But China was in a Cold War state way longer than we were. And so those are the dynamics. And each one of those things has a price point to it. But mutual assured destruction is what you also have to make sure your enemy knows, or adversary, or near peer adversary knows. Look, if you fire nuclear weapons at me, no worries, because you won't be around much longer. And so it is providing your adversary an understanding that if I die, you die, and everybody around you. And I don't want to say that I have this in the book where I talk about nuclear war and a mutual assured destruction, that this is not our grandfathers and fathers warfare thing. In World War II, they lost 100 million people. And so everyone who came out of World War II, their mindset was, look, I'm going to fight all thing I can to prevent myself from being communist. And so because they saw what it represented and how dangerous communism was. This generation has no clue about communism. We didn't see all that. Although China is currently communist, as long as we see the goods, the services, and things coming our way, and we don't think about the fact that their world is being totally dictated by one person. We don't see that. And so what we came up under as kids with Cold War, those days it's a totally different thing. People are not willing to sacrifice, or I don't want to say willing to sacrifice. But people think it's crazy. I think it's crazy that people even think to destroy a whole city. And so It's about the individual point of military capability that you're trying to destroy. So it's like, I don't think that we should even be looking at nuclear warfare even different the way they used to look at it. Now it should be I don't want to use the word pinprick attacks, because then people think you want to use nuclear weapons. But I don't think it's fair to destroy the whole world when you have opposition with one country. And so I'm in favor of reducing our missiles and the size of our missiles down to kiloton, subkiloton level. And because inevitably, as long as you can wait long enough, nuclear weapons will no longer be a viable deterrent, because the technology is going to be so advanced that they won't even be able to get from point A to point B. In another 20 years, you will be able to intercept any platform coming across or going under the water. In 20 years from now, nuclear weapons will be an anachronism. 25 years, an anachronism. It won't even be realistic to think that someone's going to try to attack you with a nuclear weapon. It'll be more cyber based along with lasers and high energy lasers and things like that destroy mass populations. It won't be nuclear weapons.
Yeah, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about the first time that we had our conversation, as far as the technologies go. And right now we're talking about economics, but technology plays a big part. So like you're saying, for the folks who aren't really following along and understanding, is I think what you're trying to let us know is, you know, the future doesn't mean that we're going to have this mass destruction of nuclear war and it destroys all of our infrastructure and things like that and mass casualties of people. That's hopefully the way it really does go. But we're talking because of technology and things being so precise, you don't need to have a weapon that destroys, you know, a 100 megaton weapon that just wipes out an entire, you know, city. Well, you're only trying to get 3 guys, but you wiped out an entire city type of thing. So the future is, like I said, it's going to be so pinpoint accurate. That's the building, that's the person, that's what it's going to destroy. But from an economic standpoint, do you have any information or anything as far as, you know, the cost of damage in war? I would imagine is quite high because of what we see, buildings, everything destroyed.
It is with the model that I use, meaning how I look at war in the future being one that is so fast and so accurate, that you know how when you try to get, you reset your password or misplace it and you send out a thing and it says, give you a number and it sends you back another pin for, and how fast it goes from the time that you're resetting your password to when your phone goes beep. So that's how fast war is going to be in the future. It's like, so if you know, you see a target, you have there's a term called left of launch strike, meaning when a missile is launched, the left of launch strike is I'm able to isolate and destroy the very launcher that launched the missile my way. And when you use AI to scan the whole 100, 500 miles of a forward battle area, and there may be 15 or 20,000 different platforms firing, but it can pinpoint each individual launcher immediately. And so when you could do send counter fires capability to that one platform and destroy it and do that times 10, 100, 2,000, then all of a sudden you're in a situation where the dynamic is going to be quick. And so whatever political gains, and there are always political gains, well, sometimes they're personal gains. Somebody just hates a group of people and wants to go to war. But typically there are political gains that some leader wants to accomplish. I mean, in China's case, they want to accomplish conquering or bringing under subjection of Taiwan. But the reality is, or when the result of that is that you have the ability to destroy lots of platforms very quickly. That being said, so how much will a war cost? Well, so the war of the future is going to be only 2 or 3 days. No, you know, I write in my book how you'll be able to find out in the first 3 hours who's going to win, whatever political position they're trying to get. The first 3 hours, you'll know how a war is going to go. And it's called the 300-second war. There's 3,600 seconds in an hour. So the 10,000-second war is what I call it. And so you're going to be able to know in the first few hours who the successor of a conflict is. But about 3 days, all those components will be done. Now, how much does each hour cost? So you're looking at not only the cost of the platforms, but also looking at the cost of economic strife that's going to happen as a result. So our global GDP is about $110 trillion. China's GDP is about 19 to $20 trillion, and our GDP is close to $28 trillion. So just like you saw with the Russian-Ukraine thing, the first thing that you're going to get, outside of the cost of losing those platforms, you're looking at a cost of about $1 trillion per hour, or $1 trillion per hour, and the longer it goes, it's going to continue to rise. But that's from just military expenses of what you've spent for the years. Economic expenses is going to be closer to $10 trillion. So after about 2 or 3 days, you're looking at close to $200 or $300 trillion that you're going to lose in global operational capacity. And so, so you're talking about freezing a country's assets. You're talking about people no longer buying products from a country made in China. So you're looking at all those things. And so all those dynamics you have to look at are going to automatically be stopped. And then you'll have a cascade of those events going into all the countries that are supplying countries or buying countries. And anybody who's aligned with the Chinese, their economy is going to tank. Anybody who are aligned with the United States, their economy won't tank initially. But as the war progresses and we're not able to come back off of that global financial crisis, then their economies will start tanking out, meaning that they will have such stress similar to COVID. You have so much stress on your economy that you'll have situations where if they don't get back into some sort of communication, economic operations, then you'll start looking at that cascade effect. Wow. So you're looking at $2 or $3 trillion.
Wow. Right now, you know, you're talking. Wow. Big numbers, large numbers. But, you know, right now you're talking about assets being frozen, countries not being able to purchase things or export, import. And with China and the U.S., we owe China a lot of money. We buy a lot from China. So it's almost to me like they've got us wrapped around their finger, because we know what'll happen if they seize exports of any of the goods. Because how many people out there, currently citizens in the U.S., run a business but they buy from China?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I say something really quick, Chuck?
You're exactly
right. Our economies are interlinked and have been interlinked for quite some time. And so since we owe them about $1.25 trillion for our securities, so we owe that to the China, and that number is going down. I think it's close to sub-$1 trillion now. But we're in a situation where that compared to the overall amount of money and the impact is inconsequential, that $1 trillion. It's more like I was saying earlier, it's like a $20, $30 trillion scenario. But also the reason is why we are now in a process called offshoring and friendshoring. And that's also, I have that in the book, where if you start putting resources in Vietnam, put resources in the Philippines, putting resources in Malaysia, putting resources in Mexico, I'm a high proponent of whatever we can get done in a nearshore friendshoring capacity, that's what we need to do. And here's the reason why. Just the same way that Vladimir Putin messed up and invaded Ukraine, Xi Jinping has managed and run his country from a central authority himself. And so he has driven his country to a point where they have all these crises. And that's what you get when you have one person with no checks and balances. And so now he wants us to help him get out of the hole that he dug himself. And so no one is talking about the fact that the situation that China currently has, 40% of youth unemployment. They have incredible numbers from the housing perspective. They have all the 3.5%, 4% economic growth. Now the list goes on and on and on. I mean, so the thing is, this is all man-made, right? From his own policies. And then they last year or early this year, they raided American companies that were stationed in China. They raided them. So if our CEO wanted to expand and do FDI, foreign direct investment, back in China, why would I do that when you're raiding our country, when you're raiding my company? So and then the China saying, hey, come back in and do business. We're great for business. No, you're not. And so you kick out all the people in Hong Kong saying, no, you can't vote. You can't do anything. You can't talk anymore. You're in jail in Hong Kong. It's just basically a prison island. And so and they want us to do trade. So you cannot perpetuate a situation that we're currently dealing with when you're seeing the result of what he did for the last 20 years. So those days are over. So my thing is, let China grow at 1.5 to 2% per annum. Call it a day. Start dialing stuff back until they change their leadership, or till the leadership changes its mind and they get something that's more akin to non-aggression and more being more mellow, which I don't know if that's going to happen. So my plan is that we have one, we have a plan, economic and military plan, to continue going like we're doing and grow our economy and military for the next 20, 30 years. Or two, make where there is an off-ramp that as they change, then we change. And we put that money on something else as opposed to our national defense. You got to have multiple plans. And that's how you look at it. You got to make it where there's an off-ramp. So the next leader, or if Xi Jinping changes his mind 4 or 5 years from now, the next leader, the next policymaker out of China says, okay, you know, let's just chill out. Let's not try to do this, that, and the other. Let's just chill out. And then we should have a policy that, okay, if you want to chill out, then we'll chill out. We won't be doing this, this, and this. Let's work together.
It all sounds easier said than done. And, you know, and I may be way off the mark on this, but a lot of times I put the blame on the general public as well, that we want, but then we want, meaning we want those issues fixed. We want to be a stronger country. We want this. We want to make sure that we are take back more of our independence away from China or other countries. But then we say, well, I want cheap goods because I don't want to spend my money. I want this. I want more of that. And it just comes right back to, well, where do you go? You know, you pick up anything and you look on the bottom of it, and what does it say? Made in China. And that's why I don't want to say it, but it's, to me, a lot of the problems that we have, we create those problems. Am I wrong with that?
Chuck, you're exactly right. And I call that feeding the dragon. So So we have gotten accustomed to spending a lot of our GDP on foreign made goods, predominantly goods that are made in China or made by Chinese owned companies. You know, so when you go buy that good or services, you're paying the price for that, and you're getting the price that you're getting an inexpensive price, but what you're getting is insecurity 5 and 10 years down the road. The insecurity is, man, if my kid goes into the military, what's the probability he's going to be having to fight to win back Taiwan because China invaded Taiwan 5 years from now? Or, you know, I run those kind of strategies. I look at that, and you have to look at the big picture. And most Americans don't look at the big picture, but that's what we do with Common Sense Defense, is we tell people about the big picture so that they can understand there is a cause and effect with what you're doing. And we have to realize, man, we got to stop spending. We got to stop feeding the dragon. You need the country to grow, because that's just that we're not being mean-spirited. We do want the country to grow, but not at the percentages they've been doing over the last 2 decades, 3 decades. There is a time in history where they're growing at 9.5% per annum, you know? So they're now, that's amazing. And so those days, you know, and some of that, as you're stating, the same way that we want good products, inexpensive, we also want a good profit. And it was American companies dumping in hundreds of billions of dollars in foreign direct investment into China for decades. So now we can realize, oh my gosh, this is not working out the way we thought it should work out, because, man, they're really kicking us. They're really running us around here. And so now we're realizing the reality of that. So we fed the dragon for 30 years. They entered the World Trade Organization in 2000, and they had just been going roughshod over our economy since before then. So now we got to figure out, what do we want to do for the next 20 years or 25 years? And if we don't carpe diem, seize the day right now, seize this moment and realize, oh no, we're not going to continue putting money in your country like the way we have been. We have to make that decision now. The American people do, not the government, the American people, because it's the American people that go to Costco, Walmart, Sam's Club, Myers, and all these wonderful places that we go. We're the American people who do that. We have to say, you know what? Not going to do it anymore. And let's go see where else we can get some of the goods and services that we need. And then when we start thinking that, then after about 5 or 10 years after we make that decision, then we'll see China that's economically chastened enough so that they won't have the excess capacity to make all this aircraft carriers and submarines and nuclear missiles and bombers and all these things that we have to say, oh my gosh, how are we going to position for that? And that's what the American people have to make that decision, to your point. We, the American people, have to make that decision that we won't be buying all those Chinese-owned goods.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, we're fighting the war on multiple fronts and two big fronts. Like I said, it's the economic front, from a day-to-day basis, it's much larger than, than a military front. Just because it's an everyday thing, and the 300-plus million Americans are partaking in that. We are the ground soldiers in that war, but we are not doing ourselves any good.
We're not. You're right. And we're not doing our kids any good, because no. They're the ones who got to go fight. Our sons and daughters are the ones who have to go fight, fly, or sail in that area with weapons that we helped purchase over a decade, 2 decades. You hate to say it that way, but I mean, so you got to look at it that way. And then you have to also look at the fact that there's over 250,000 Chinese students that are learning at our educational institutions, and they're going back to China. And I have no problem with if you're learning horticulture and learning things about the growth, but I'm talking about engineers that are going back to China and making missiles and airplanes and weapons that are coming back towards us 5 and 10 years from now. You see what I'm saying? You cannot feed academically a people group or country, excuse me, not a people group, but a country that is using those same tools to develop weapons against your children. I mean, that's not complex. That doesn't make any sense to me. It shouldn't make any sense to the average everyday American that 5 years from now, that person who's got their PhD in microeconomics, I mean, no, not microeconomics, that's not going to be an economics situation, small electronics, nanotechnology, that's what I want to say.
Yeah.
And or AI, and they come back 5 years from now, that's going to be a bigger situation. So that's how we have to look at that as Americans, that yes, we want to educate anybody in the world who wants to be educated in our country, but it can't be with technology that's going to hurt our country. You would think that we learned that in the 9/11 attacks. We taught those young men how to fly planes, and they did not learn how to land them. They just blew up our people, right? So you've got to have some type of constraints on how you educate people understanding the bigger picture.
It's such a difficult thing because we have such a diverse culture here, you know, and we have, we could break down probably in 3 or 4 different groups, but I'm just going to say the left and the right type of situation, not to get political, but we do have the left and the right. And those who say we need to be open to everything and everyone, and it needs to be exactly even across the board, whether you come across from the border, from wherever. And we have those others who say, stop, not so much. We need to put other policies into place. And that's such a hard thing to do, but you're absolutely right. There are individuals that come in from other countries and learn what we're learning what we learned, the exact same thing, and then taking it home. And, you know, they have all the tools that we do. So how is it that we're going to be bigger and better and faster than they are?
It's a policy issue, Chuck. The policy is, if your country is on a trajectory to try and want to destroy my country, then I'm not going to teach and train you on how to make the weapons.
Yeah.
So, and so whether it is material sciences, whether it's electronics, whether it's antimatter, whatever, if your country is trying to destroy my country or trying to outmaneuver my country militarily, your child, your student is not going to be learning the capability to be able to execute that vision and direction of your country. And that's how, once you set a policy in place that says that, now we're not trying to stop the students from learning, but they're not going to be learning A, B, C, and D. Now, you do have those actors that are bad people, and they could be from right down the street or right across the pond, and they're bad actors. But as a whole, if the students are from a country that are trying to destroy your country, then you're not going to try to help their military by educating those students.
Yeah. That's such a tough thing to, it's easy to think about, but it's so hard to understand, I think, because I think as a group, in America, I think we want to be fair and right and even because of everything that we have done in the past and, in our past history to certain groups of people. And I think that right now is such a big deal that it is causing, and it's going to have a huge effect 5, 10, 20 years down the road where we will pay the price. So just like what you're saying. And somebody that's listening that I know is going to say to me, I didn't know you were like that. I'll say, no, I'm not like that. I'm just listening to what is being said and opening my eyes to, the reality.
If you look at it from a national security perspective, it becomes easier. And we cannot look at it from the lens of race or ethnicity. We must look at it from a lens of national security and what political backing a student has from that country. And if they're trying to hurt you militarily or economically to prevent your nation from being strong, that's the reason. It's not an ethnic or racial concern. It is a political or an ideological or a military, a national security concern is what we should be looking at. And once you look at it from that, it's easier because you want to make sure that people understand, look, it's not about race. It's not about ethnicity. It is about national security. And that is, it doesn't matter whether you're Republican, Democrat, or independent. Everyone should want to protect our nation or protect their child who's going to. For me, it all goes back to Chuck, to the children. I'm like, whatever we see, I don't think it's going to happen next week or month. But eventually, one of my children in their teens is eventually going to be able to be in the military to go and be on the front. And so for me, I look at policy right now on how does that policy affect my children and anybody else whose ages are children. My youngest child is 8 years old. So I'm going to be thinking this way for a very long time. And then, and nothing like when you take your child down to the post office and they have to sign up for the, for the Selective Service, that distills to you, man, I really want the country to make some good decisions, because that's my child that may have to go to war because of some bad policies, decisions the policymaker makes. So that's when it distills to the reality. It's not about race. It's not about ethnicity. It is about what your, it's about your national security.
Yeah. You know, like in your book, China Rising, Case for Containment, where the threat is immediate. It's not 10 years from now. The effect, if we don't contain it right now, okay, is, will happen.
Yes.
So it's, I guess what I'm trying to say is 100% in agreement with what you're saying and voicing, if I could say, voicing your opinion out there to all of us. And I heed what you're saying. I understand exactly. But the way you put it too, it's not about race. It's not about the culture or anything like that. It's about our nation's security. So think about it that way. You live here. Yes. You are a citizen of this country. You are a person of this country. You want to protect, just like your home. You want to protect your home. Yes. So why not your country? Your country is your home as well. So, yeah, when you think about it that way, you do want to do more to prevent things from happening. And what that means is do it now.
Do it now.
Not later.
That is that's a million-dollar statement. Right. Do it now and not later. And I think that once we understand as American citizens that when we buy something from the store, that's something we can do now. As American citizens, when we vote for or call a Congress, I call Congress people, and state our feelings, that we state them saying, look, spend more on defense or spend defense money this way, you're showing that you are educated or interested in how our defense policy is made. That's something that can be done right now, you know. And so supporting defense, believe it or not, supporting defense companies that are looking for workers who help in the submarine industrial base or the shipyard industrial base. There are kids who say, hey, I don't know, what should I be doing? Hey, well, maybe you should go work for a company that works with CNC machines or additive manufacturing. All those, or maybe you should get a major that deals with material science or quantum computing, you know. So it's pushing children to, or showing children or students that there are areas that you can go in that can help our nation, whether you can go into the military or you can, from a college perspective or trade school perspective, go into specialties that help our nation's trajectory using your skills. And so those are things that can be done now. So there's a lot of things that we can do now that cumulatively change the direction of our country. Because like for our submarine industrial base, we need 100,000 workers. For our ship and yard industrial base, they need 250,000 workers over the next, just to get done what we need to get done, just to put ships out there. And so that's all, that's important. And we need workers and people who want to do that now.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're kind of reaching into the a little bit of a different area with education, because when I think about that, there are so many people who are whether displaced from work, or there are a lot of, I think, what do they call it now, Gen Zs or whatever it might be, or whatever position that they're in, they either don't know what to do or don't have a direction, maybe. And if there was a time when we really valued trade school, trades. And I think we've gotten away from that. And I think we need to get back into that as far as education goes. And like you said, focus on those areas that possibly will help the country, whether it be defense or not. And you may say, well, I don't want to work directly for one of our branches. Well, you're working in the shipyard, right? That's a benefit for us. You're working at aircraft mechanic, you're working as a maintenance person at any of these type of facilities, all those are of a benefit to the individual and yes, the country. And they are a benefit now and in the future. So
that's exactly
why correct. Why don't we invest in trade schools and stuff like that anymore? What happened?
I think COVID happened. I think the technology bump happened. I think the artificial intelligence bump happened. So these disruptors, so you have disruptors that happen in an economy that just change the paradigm how things are. And I think when we had a confluence of events that happened in the last, I mean, you have disruptors that take about 2 or 3 years to happen. So, but we had a confluence of events that happened simultaneously. We had a national realization that I don't want to just like work a job that has no meaning. That hit people right through the COVID time where people, and so people had to reassess how much time I want to work per week. Where do I want to work? Can I work off site? Can I work from my own home? How, you know, if I'm going to live somewhere, I want to live in a house that's sitting out looking at a mountainside. This realization about life and all these things, they're introspective thoughts people have. So you have that social or psychological impact. Then you have a confluence of dual technologies. You had robotics that have changed the supply chain. And so, so the robotics coming in from a manufacturing perspective, that has changed. And then you have automation. So there's automation, then there's robotics. Those two things are separate. Automation is a way that things move quickly and you don't need human intervention. You have automation, then you have robotics, and now we have artificial intelligence, and then you have quantum capabilities. And all these technologies have really come into fruition over the last 3 to 5 years. And so in each one of those jobs, as a spinoff of that, it takes less people to operate. So what's going to end up happening and has started happening is you have a level of efficiency that a system can operate, because since we're 72 to 75% services in our nation, different systems, it takes less to operate. And so because of that, that's why our country hasn't fell apart, because it's so automated and things have worked in such a way that it doesn't need all those people. So the people, yes, they need to work, but the system continue to work without those people. And we're realizing that. And then military is going to be the same way 5 and 10, 15 years from now, the same way. That's not the purpose of this discussion track. But so as our economy starts to deal with 5 different disruptors simultaneously, then we're looking, oh my goodness, then where are things going? And that's why the Chinese are tripping out so much about us putting a block on them getting certain types of semiconductors, because you need semiconductors that can do multiple levels of computations and do them quickly to produce the next cutting edge technology. And if you don't have the semiconductors, then your technology won't work. And so those are all those things coming together is what we're dealing with now. And so that's why. And so the kids or the people who are their Gen Zers, they are in a system where they have this bubble that as long as they have some money from their moms or dads or from somewhere, then they're still trying to figure out what they want to do. And they have the leeway to do that because the country is so efficient and it's producing so much capacity. And we don't need them at this juncture to do some of those things. But conversely, things like services, like manufacturing, like industry, like transportation, we need people. And so what's going to happen is we're going to eventually, if they don't jump on board, then automation will replace them in the next 4 to 7 years, where the truck will be autonomous, where the trucking industry needed, I think, 60 or 70,000 workers. They won't need those. You'll see trucks driving without a human being on them. So certain things will be, you know, but so we're going to have, there's going to be a correction happening in our industry that the country continues to develop. And then we have to find something else for those. And then more than likely, I think there's this term they said for the alpha generation, the generation after Generation Z, the alpha generation, they said 50% of the jobs that those children will have down the road have not even been thought about yet. So that's where technology puts you, that where you can do such computations and operations. And if you look at the agility of the new robots, the humanoids, the fact they can lift up 110 pounds and do different types of things, they're going to be eventually replacing. So that's what's happening. We have a flux of people that don't want to work, but we also have a technology capability that's compensating. And then you'll start seeing those mutual disruptors happen and change our country, not the culture, economic.
And those listening right now, make no mistake, what we're talking about as far as the economy, economics, and things like that in the future and technology goes, this all has to do with, bottom line, it comes down to defending our country. So technology, economy, armed forces, it all plays into it. So it's very, very important. Once again, could you remind us where folks go to purchase your book, to listen to your podcast, and you also have a YouTube channel as well, right?
Yes. Thank you, Chuck. Yes. They can go to Common Sense Defense Podcast, commonsensedefensepodcast.com. And you also can go to Common Sense Defense YouTube channel, and you'll be able to get our YouTube and all of those things will be able to point you back to the book. And the book is called China Rising, the Case for Containment. There we go. China Rising, the Case for Containment. And that you will be able to go straight to that through the Common Sense Defense Podcast page or the YouTube page.
Fantastic. Ptolemy Pruden, thank you very much again. Both times, I mean, you have opened my eyes to really not just wanting, but needing to be aware. So, and I hope others will do the same. One thing that I wanted to ask you too, because oftentimes an individual thinks that they cannot make a difference. And I think that we can as individuals in reaching out to our senators and things like that, our local politicians. Is that something that is helpful, do you think?
Most assuredly. So they have a tally. When you're calling from your own zip code, the first thing that they want to know is, where are you calling from? And if you're not calling out of their district, calling in their district, they're not going to pay you any attention. I mean, just that's just the way that it is. So from around the country, you have to be able to call your congressman, congressperson, and say, look, I'm in favor of us having a strong Navy. Can you build our Navy? Or can you push, can you pay attention to this policy or what have you? They'll listen to you because they'll tally them out. They also do voice recordings, and I think they have a transcript of the voice recorder, so they're able to track it that way. So even leaving a voicemail is not bad. That's a good thing. So yes, reaching out to your congressperson is very, very important because they pay attention. And every 10, 100, 1,000 that they get, they pay even more attention. And so, so calling is important, very, very important.
Okay. Well, you heard it. We as individuals, we do matter and we do count. So every vote, every call, everything counts. So once again, thank you very much. It's been very, very informative. I have enjoyed my time with you.
Me too. Thank you, Chuck. Me too. I really enjoyed hanging out and talking to you.
Thanks.